Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio. We're doing a series of programs to explain what are the top breakthroughs in science, as determined by Science Magazine, publication of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Today in the studio, along with Russ Chianelli, we've got Dr. Kyle Johnson from the Department of Biological Sciences and Dr. Aaron Velasco from the Department of Geological Sciences. And we're going to talk about two things. One was the vaccine that was developed last year, I guess, against Ebola. And the other is to do with, do volcanoes really go down all the way to the middle of the Earth? So, Kyle, do you want to tell us what was the big breakthrough as science sort of pinpointed it for us?
Really, the big breakthrough was in development of a new vaccine against Ebola. And the problem is with this outbreak is that there were only experimental treatments and no vaccines to protect people. And consequently, something like 11,000 people plus died from this outbreak. So this particular vaccine uses a novel viral strategy that uses another virus to launch an Ebola protein that the immune response is made against and that protects people against the virus.
Why is that different from a traditional vaccine?
It's actually very similar to other vaccine strategies. In fact, this vesicular stomatitis virus that was used to launch it has been used for other vaccines and is particularly effective. In this particular case, what they did is to use a vaccine strategy that was used for smallpox, and that was one that uses rings or clusters. So you have an infected individual who's been confirmed to have Ebola. You look at all of the contacts of that person and their contacts. So it would be household members, people that have close personal contact versus maybe neighbors and people that live in maybe a neighboring village. And so you identify the person who's sick and all of these other contacts and you vaccinate them.
Okay, so it's very targeted as opposed
to very targeted.
Where we go with you got your 3-year-old child and he gets a vaccination for everybody gets that.
This is
simply because it was new, very little of it, that it had to be more targeted.
Exactly. And that's often what's done in these clinical trials in which they have a number of different phases of taking a vaccine candidate and putting it into people. This vaccine candidate had already gone through phase 1 and 2, and now starting in about March of 2015 was done in a slightly larger group of people. I think altogether maybe 7,000 or so people that were tested with this vaccine. And with this strategy, they had, of these contacts that they identified, they had a randomized trial of we either vaccinate those contacts immediately or we wait 21 days and then vaccinate them. And in the people that were vaccinated in that first group of immediate vaccinees, 100% of them were protected from Ebola. So that really is an efficacy that has not been seen previously and is really an outstanding
result.
Exactly.
What was the point of the 21 days? That was just to take a different time period and see if it made any difference?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And indeed, it did make a difference in that as opposed to in the immediate vaccination group, there were no cases of Ebola that developed from the vaccine or in those particular individuals, but 16 cases in the case where they waited 21 days, which essentially the 21 days is what they considered to be an incubation period.
Okay.
And in fact, now in the countries that have declared or WHO has declared them free of Ebola, they actually have to wait 2 of those 21-day incubation periods to be declared.
To say you're Ebola free.
Exactly.
But there's an ethical feature to that sort of experiment, though. Why subject those people to wait 21 days? Why not find out whether it was successful immediately for everybody in that contact group?
Well, you would think that would be the case, but in a lot of vaccine situations, for instance, they do start with a particular experimental design, which is approved by the FDA, or in this case, the World Health Organization. And so they have to set certain milestones up front.
Right.
But then there have been other trials, for instance, HIV trials, where they have proven to be not effective. And so some of those trials have been even halted in the middle. Or some drug trials, maybe you have a randomized group that isn't getting treated and the treated group is getting better. And so in some of those cases, they may discontinue that aspect and then, for instance, treat everybody.
Okay.
So that's been done as well.
So how is this now impacting the Ebola crisis that's in Africa and that we all worried about?
Well, frankly, the crisis is considered for 2014/15 to be in abeyance.
Yeah.
There are no new cases in Sierra Leone, Liberia, or Guinea at this time. I think the idea is that there have been outbreaks previously to this in West Africa and in other parts of Africa, and the idea is that there will be future outbreaks. And so if we use this as an example of, hey, we need to get ready, we need to prepare vaccines and treatments so that when there's another outbreak, we're ready, that's the position that we're in now.
And that's just specifically to Ebola. But there's a lot of other nasties out there. Right?
Yes.
And from my point of view, one of the successful reasons why maybe this was pinpointed as a breakthrough is the rapidity with which, and I think 3-4 years is quite rapid, maybe I'm wrong, but the rapidity with which the disease was identified had a big impact to the time that we got the vaccine, and so we're almost free of it. Am I right to think that's important and rather beautiful?
That is important, but I think in a way it's an oversimplification, as we have been dealing with Ebola as a scientific community since 1975.
Ah.
So trying to develop new treatments, trying to develop vaccines, and it's only really now with this outbreak being in an unprecedented size, instead of just isolated villages where people get infected and there may be a very high mortality rate and then the virus essentially it is no longer causing any active outbreaks, but the virus is still there. It's present in the environment. It's present in animals in the area. So it's not that the virus ever goes away. It's just, do people come in contact with the virus on a regular basis? Now, in this particular outbreak, this is the first time that we've had a large major city with an international airport be affected by an outbreak of this size, which is probably what contributed to its spreading.
And probably also with respect to what made the developed countries look at it more seriously, perhaps? Or is that too jaundiced an opinion?
I think that's perhaps a little jaundiced.
Okay.
I think certainly the people in the scientific community have been taking this seriously for years. And I think that's what made this vaccination strategy happen so quickly, is all the research that's gone into how to do it, how to make a rapid vaccine that could be applied to any other target. So it's Ebola today, it could be Marburg virus tomorrow. We're seeing outbreaks of all sorts of tropical diseases. We see dengue in Hawaii and Puerto Rico. We're seeing Zika virus now throughout Brazil. And
I always get nervous when people come on and talk about viruses. I just don't want to leave the studio. I mean, it seems they're all out there just waiting for us, right? There's a lot of them.
There are a lot of them, but in a lot of cases, you don't ever come in contact with them.
Right.
This vaccine is responsible in part for stopping the outbreak that occurred.
I think it is. This vaccine is responsible in part for stopping the outbreak. In Guinea, there have been a number of other clinical trials that are ongoing as well, in terms of also finding new other ways of vaccination and other new treatments. And so these are things where a number of different research groups are working all simultaneously on different candidates to try to approach from as many different angles as possible the outbreak.
Is there still a feeling out there amongst the population that vaccination is dangerous? I mean, I know that it went through that scare by some British doctor that put something out totally erroneous to do with mercury or something. I don't know quite the issues.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that we've sort of overcome that?
Oh, I don't think so.
I
think there still is, among certain groups at least, huge amounts of distrust of the vaccination process and the necessity to vaccinate kids against even normal childhood diseases.
Could you talk a little bit about that? I have two daughters with grandchildren, and they talk about that all the time. Should we stop the vaccinations? There's a lot of evidence for that.
I personally don't think so. We certainly see things like measles, that it's a normal childhood disease, that as soon as you stop vaccinating, you see huge outbreaks. And whether it's measles, whether it's even now recurrence of some diseases like pertussis, whooping cough, that essentially had been totally cleared, wiped out using the vaccine, as soon as people stop using vaccination, those diseases are coming back.
What was it that scared the mothers?
What scared the mothers was that this particular researcher who had a side business in selling drugs for autism tried to say to the parents, this vaccine causes autism, so if you get your kid vaccinated, you're going to need my treatment so that they will get over the autism that the he claimed vaccine was giving them. Now, that has actually been shown to be a case of scientific dishonesty in which the
entrepreneurship run amok.
Exactly. Right. And there have been countless studies that show no correlation at all between vaccination and...
And that cannot be repeated enough.
Exactly.
It's absolutely nothing to fear.
For example, I've reached
a certain age where they tell me I need vaccination against, what's this, skin disease where you
shingles.
Itch? Shingles, right. Or pneumonia. Mm-hmm. I haven't quite done it yet. I get my flu shot every year, but should I get shingles shot? Norma says yes, right?
Yes.
Okay.
If you're over 65,
yeah, well,
by all
just
means.
About. Well, I'll go straight there. So, Kyle Johnson, what do you do? You're into this game of developing vaccines?
A little bit.
What are you aiming at?
I am primarily aiming at discovering more from a basic science standpoint, how does a family of viruses reproduce itself? And this is a virus that doesn't infect humans, which makes it safe for me and my students to work on. But it gives us a lot of insight into how other viruses like common cold viruses are actually reproducing.
That brings up an interesting point. I have to have a different flu vaccination every year because mm-hmm. that particular virus is constantly mutating and changing.
That's correct.
Why doesn't the Ebola virus do the same thing and all these others, the shingles virus? What's the difference?
They do mutate all the time.
So we've got to make a new
moving target. But the viruses are different. For instance, poliovirus, once you get vaccinated against that, you're covered essentially for your lifetime.
But why?
The virus mutates, but it doesn't have as clever a strategy for changing its outer coat.
Okay.
And so the immunity that we're making is very often against the proteins on the outer surface. And
got
so
it.
If your mutations don't affect that, then...
So on the IQ level, the flu virus is top of the IQ class.
It's In my opinion, it is.
Mm-hmm. You've been listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chinelli. We've been talking with Dr. Kyle Johnson. And we'll be back in one moment to talk about volcanoes, vents to the core of the Earth with Professor Aaron Velasco. Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chinelli. And now we're going to be talking to Professor Aaron Velasco because what we're doing in these series of programs is evaluating the interest in the top science breakthroughs of 2016 as determined by the magazine Science, publication of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Now, Aaron, when I was a kid, you know, it was always wonderful to my professor in England, Professor Dunham, was always going to volcanoes and bringing back beautiful films and movies. And we used to think, boy, do those go all the way down to the middle of the Earth? Now, I gather we've sort of resolved that to a certain extent.
Yes and no. And what's really fascinating about this particular study or this particular approach that they've taken is that we're getting clearer images of the deep Earth, which we've never had before. The volcanoes that we normally visit are actually fairly shallow features where they don't have these roots that go down to the core.
By images, you're talking about by geophysics getting...
Yes, sort of similar to your CAT scan,
yeah.
You know, that we take to image that sort of thing. The challenge in the Earth, though, is that with a CAT scan, you have sensors on one side and you know, sources on the other, and the person goes into this machine, and this machine rotates and is able to get great images. With the Earth, we have sources like earthquakes, but they're not randomly distributed. They're in certain zones. We have sensors on the Earth. Most of them are on the surface of the continents. And, you know, 75% of the Earth is ocean, so it's a very tough thing to do is to image all of the Earth as you go down deep. And so this advancement is utilizing new data. And when I say new data, I'm saying years of data that we've been able to collect in the digital era. And being able to use that information to really capture these images. We've known for years that plate tectonics works where plates interact and that some of those interactions you get these volcanoes and whatnot, which is what you would go normally visit. But we're talking about something is quite a bit different that starts really at the core. A great example is Hawaii. Hawaii is a great example of what we call a hotspot. It's in the middle of the oceanic plate. There's no reason for it to be there in the plate tectonics perspective. But where does that source of magma come from? And what we're discovering, and which a lot of people have suspected, some of it comes deep down at the actual core mantle boundary, which is where the outer liquid core intersects with the sort of hard rock mantle.
So if they were to do an analysis of this particular type of magma, can you see elemental distributions that are very different because the plume is down there, way deep compared to the more shallow ones along the edge of continental drifts?
That's a great question. And I think that that's what some of the modeling is about, is to see what that sort of thermal chemical structure really is as it comes from the core mantle boundary. The other thing is that, you know, we think of these things as starting near there, these plumes, if you will, and they have like mushroom heads, like a mushroom cloud. And as they migrate to the surface, strange things are known to have happened. We suspect, for example, that when a plume head interacts with the surface, that you get what we call flood basalts. That is, the whole area just floods with this hot rock. But as something migrates from that deep down, there's bound to be differentiation and sort of, you know, reactions to the surrounding material and stuff like that. So what we see at the surface doesn't necessarily look any abnormal that it came from the core mantle boundary, but there's been a long process as perhaps changed that sort of chemical
Well, another question then from this. What makes 2015 a seminal year in this study, which has been collecting data for a decade or more?
What really is significantly different about this particular body of work is that we're getting much more clear images down deep. And that's a challenge. And it has to do with the physics of how things work. If you imagine when you stick a yardstick in a bowl of water, glass bowl, you see what looks like the ruler bending, even though you know that it doesn't bend. That's refraction. And what happens in the Earth when you have like a hot body, it bends the seismic waves around it. So you can never really get a good image of that. Even a magma chamber is very hard to image, like a shallow magma chamber, because the rays just bend around it and you really can't see it. So the idea here is to use a new data set that hasn't been used before. Many times in seismology, we use what's called the first arrival, which basically that means is that we have an earthquake, we measure the time at which the first wave, comes through at a seismic station, and we throw everything else away. Now, that's so simple. I mean, there's so much more information. So this study is trying to use the amplitude of the waves, the frequency at which it comes in, all these particular things, which have been computationally impossible to do. So it's a really good mix of using numerical techniques plus data analysis that have been allowed us to be able to see deep down in the Earth that we just haven't seen.
What have we learned new about the Earth that we didn't know before by using these techniques?
We've confirmed a lot of things, but we've also learned – there's something really significant about this particular find. What they're saying is that our image of a mantle plume is like this really narrow pipe that's feeding the systems, this narrow pipe. And what they're showing is that it's not narrow at all. It's this really broad zone that is coming to the surface as one particular unit. And maybe when it hits the upper mantle, which is about 660 kilometers deep, some of it penetrates, some of it doesn't. Some of it, you know, gets sort of captured in other sort of convection currents. We just haven't seen that before. So Earth is much more complex than what we have ever imagined.
Yeah, because I was reading that in fact there were some theories that there was just pools of magma somehow trapped higher up than the core interface.
Yes.
And that these were responsible. Are there examples of that?
Yes,
where
there's
sort of a pirate chunk of magma somewhere?
There's a bigger question here that it's kind of esoteric. I mean, there's something we call whole mantle convection and dual mantle convection. Dual cell. And so what the idea is that there's a big boundary at about 660 kilometers in depth. Above that's the upper mantle. Below that, to the core mantle boundary, is the lower mantle. And the idea is that convection, which drives the plates, we know that as evidence, are those actually two separate cells of convection or are they one? And so that still has not been solved, believe it or not. This is 40 years later, and we still haven't figured that out. This is kind of an interesting piece because it still shows there's some separation between the upper and lower mantle, but it's also showing that, you know, these things penetrate all the way through that.
It would also
valley.
Have something to do with prediction of earthquakes if it's figured out, no?
Probably not prediction of earthquakes, but what's interesting, another component is the core mantle boundary itself. And the reason why that's important to everyone is because that boundary may be controlling and contributing to our magnetic field that protects us. So this is sort of, even though it sounds like a really esoteric subject and deep earth and whatnot, it's a very important subject for a lot of people. And for all of us, I should say.
Oh, especially for geophysicists.
Especially for us.
Yeah, right.
But, I mean, it also, you know, there's questions about magnetic field reversals, and when that happens, does a field go down? And when it goes down, it makes us all vulnerable to those harmful cosmic rays.
Simple question. Do you get I lived in Hawaii for about 5 months. I don't remember an earthquake. Do they get earthquakes?
Absolutely.
And so these are different from the earthquakes that we get on the interface between plates. What causes the earthquake there? Because you say it's in the middle of the Pacific plate. And so what is rubbing up against something else in order to – or is it just from the core?
That's a great question. So what's happening in Hawaii is that material's piling up. And if you actually took away the ocean, Hawaii is the largest mountain range in the world.
Right.
And so what happens at near the surface, though, is that there's readjustments of stresses as this material's, you know, continues to accumulate, and you actually get faults. That are related to the volcanoes as the upwelling occurs and stuff settles and cools. And so you get all those processes, which are typical. You won't necessarily get a magnitude 9 out there, but you will get, you know, earthquakes as large as 6s.
And I remember being in Nicaragua a number of years ago where there was a hole in the earth that everybody visited. And the Spanish used to say, that down there is the gate to hell. It didn't prevent them from going down and getting gold there, but there's a place there where you can look and see the core molten. You know, it's a huge, huge place.
Well, it's probably not the core that's there, but what it is definitely a molten magma body,
yeah,
which you would expect in that particular area because of the subduction process that's occurring off the coast and generating those volcanoes all along, you know, Central America.
Are there going to be in the future? Now, geological future is obviously no one's going to be around to say Velasco got it wrong. But, I mean, do you begin to understand that there are a new Hawaiian islands that are going to be produced? I mean, I know in Iceland they keep seeing things appear and then disappear. Is there another part of, say, the Pacific plate where holes are going to be punctured to create new big mountains and new tropical islands?
Likely, yes. I mean, the Earth is – I always tell my students, the Earth is alive. I mean, it's really alive. It's constantly in motion. It's just that it functions on a time scale that we just don't see a lot of change. And so there's likely to be, you know, oceans opening up, oceans closing, new volcanic systems coming to fruition.
So those other little islands out there, all these Polynesian islands, are they also the same idea, the tips of big mountains, or is there a different – because you don't hear Bora Bora. I mean, I don't think there's a big volcanic issue down there, but how have those islands formed?
Well, a lot of times what happens when oceanic plates form initially is that you get shoot-offs of small already volcanic systems that are being fed from that as it's splitting apart. And so that's – those are older, not necessarily growing anymore. And as those mountains have grown, other craters have basically grown on top of it and created, you know, the reefs that really generate the islands. But it really starts from that process of where you really
start.
But
if you looked at the picture of the around those Polynesian islands, are they also like ranges of mountains from way down?
There are some that are like that, yes. Yes, absolutely. But they're old. They're not necessarily active
anymore.
Yeah.
The other thing that we haven't discussed, which fascinated me and we worked on, was deep sea vents, because there's a lot of people say the deep sea vents and the molten stuff coming out was where the molecules for the origins of life were created.
Absolutely. And so in the oceans, basically the plates are splitting apart. You get new material. That's where the bulk of the volcanic activity in the world is along these long ridges. Iceland is basically an example of the ridge reaching the surface. And so that's a great example of a mid-ocean ridge reaching the surface. But in general, that's where you get that.
Geologic time is infinite. Radio Science Studio time, finite. We've used it all. Aaron Velasco, Geological Sciences. Good to have you all here. We'll be back next week with yet another program to look at some of the advances in physics and in planetary science.
Thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And thank you for listening. Take care. Bye-bye.